Thank you for tuning in to the Movie Geeks United celebration of the hit TV series Breaking Bad. A little bit later on in the show, we'll replay snippets from our past interviews with Breaking Bad co-stars Stephen Bauer, Mark Margolis, and Robert Forrester. But first, in the hours leading up to the finale of the series, the Movie Geeks join together to discuss what they love about the show and how we'd ultimately like to see it conclude. I rewatched most of the first season when they just replayed it on AMC, and I was surprised because I didn't remember it being so darn comical. I mean, it's always been darkly funny in some ways, the series, but it was really like the shock of this guy that doesn't belong in that world, and they got a lot of comedy out of his fumbling around in that nefarious underworld in those initial episodes. And Jesse, too. I mean, Jesse started off very comical as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we all laugh at his, you know, tagline, everything has to end with bitch. Like, yo, bitch. Yeah. I mean, Jesse was very funny. But I don't think I've seen a TV show where a character has been so relentlessly tortured like Jesse has. And I'm talking emotionally as well as physically.
Yeah.
I mean,
well, Jesse just gets beat up repeatedly. I mean, he gets beat up more than, you know, Mike Hammer does in Kiss Me Deadly or whatever. I mean, like, he's just beat up repeatedly, and he's crying, like, more, you know, watching it, you know, in a row, you know. He's just like, this guy, this is an emotional guy. They're both, I mean, you know, it's funny when you look at both of the characters of Walter and Jesse, they're actually both, like, really not cut out for this game.
That's the irony, though. Isn't that the great irony of the thing? Is how everyone, and I mean, I just want to read you this, they interviewed all the cast in Rolling Stone, and, you know, they asked Walt, you know, the guy says, Walt changes very quickly from a school teacher into a ruthless drug lord. Was his violence always close to the surface? And this is what Bryan Cranston said. My theory is everyone is capable of being dangerous. And I think there's a lot of truth to that, but I think what's really great, you have this chemistry teacher, the last person you expect in the world, and he just becomes, you know, makes Tony Montana look like a Boy Scout almost. I mean, he is ruthless beyond belief.
Well, let's just get it straight, first of all, here. When I watched the show, what I realized is this. Walt feels like if he can keep the lie going,
mm-hmm.
it's fine. But once the lie falls through, he feels like he has nothing else to lose. And this is what drives him totally insane. This is what flips him over into the world of truly being Heisenberg, not being Walter White.
I see that.
Well, and the cancer diagnosis has a lot to do with it, too. I mean, the whole premise of the show is that what set him on this journey was how that diagnosis kind of freed him, because he was someone
mm-hmm.
that never spoke up, someone that everyone thought was a nice guy, but, you know, he could disappear in a room, I'm sure.
Right.
He failed in terms of business. You know, his cohorts in business, they made a big splash and became millionaires, multimillionaires for their efforts, and Walter White just didn't have that. There was something in him that held him back, and so the diagnosis frees him up.
Well, I think also that at that point he thinks once he beats cancer, he feels like he can beat death.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a real one of my favorite scenes, and I have a list of favorite scenes that I want to talk about later, but this is
mm-hmm.
among them. That scene that I don't think a lot of people talk about, but there's a great scene in the third season after the explosion in the sky with the airplanes that hit and everything. Walt is at a school assembly.
Yeah.
And he's given the microphone at school assembly to talk about his feelings about the plane crash. And he says, hey, listen, you know, planes crash all the time. I mean, you know, the biggest plane crash killed 600 people, and who remembers that? And he says, really, the thing is, we get past this. We get past this. We survive. And surviving is all there is. And that's it.
Right.
That's almost
no, you're absolutely
his
right.
confession.
A lot of the terrible things that he's done in the course of the series has to do with self-preservation. You know, and it's been done under the cloak of I'm only doing this for the good of my family. But that disappeared a while ago. Because you do get a sense that Walter White is driven more by ego. And I think you saw it too at the end of the last episode. Whatever his plan is that'll carry him on to this finale. At the end of that last episode, when he sees them on the television, his ego is wounded, and that's what inspires him to kind of come back from it in whatever fashion he will. I read that they said, you know, he's at this point he's not Walter White, and he's not Heisenberg, he's something else. I heard one of the it could have been Vince Gilligan that said that. And I think that means that, you know, Heisenberg is someone to be feared, but he's rational and calculating. And Walter White is that timid family man. So if it's something else, I think he's just going purely on violent id at this point in this last episode.
Mm-hmm.
That's my feeling anyway.
Yeah. I mean, you know, not just ego, but also anger. Just pure, pure anger at being tossed over.
Well, of course. I mean, it's a natural reaction. I mean,
yeah. I mean, I think you know, one thing that's real interesting about the show that I've found, like, you know, watching it again, is that I really think that this show, while not being, you know, obviously, while not being overtly political, I think that this show is extremely political if you really look at it, especially in terms of what's going on now, and especially in terms of look, the show started in 2008, so let's just take that for example. I mean,
I think I know where you're going with this, but you go.
Of the economic downturn. Really, what this show is about somebody who's part of the 99%. He's a lowly, low-paid teacher. And he's really somebody that is at sort of a crossroads where he has to make a decision, and this is because of medical problems, which are medical coverage is one of the number one things that we're talking about these days. He can't afford the medical coverage, so he decides to try and make his way into the 1%. And this show is really about what happens when somebody from the 99% tries to cut all of the middlemen out and try and break their way into the 1% and what that takes.
Mm-hmm.
And why he does it, and at least initially why he does it. And then later on it becomes different. It becomes okay. So eventually he is part of the 1%. So he has $3 million or $4 million. That's not even really part of the 1%.
No, he's still a piker.
He's still a piker. He's still nothing. You know, and he wants to go further and further, and he's willing to break more rules and more rules. Well, how many of the rules do you think that he breaks that people who are part of the 1% have broken 1,000 times?
No, that's true. There's a hypocrisy. But you're also bringing up a very important point. You're saying that he keeps trying to go up the ladder. Who else? What other great, great, great criminal mastermind? What was his whole goal? To always go legitimate. Always. And could never do it. Even when he thought he had done it, it turns out he really
exactly.
didn't. This goes back to Michael Corleone. It goes back really, even Tony Montana in a very... It is the thing that this is their, how should I say it, this is their ticket to their place. They're trying to get that place at the table.
Uh-huh.
And it's very important because this is, I think, you brought up really the appeal of the show to me. It is this thing, how do we get, because there is this enormous gap right now, more so than, I think even maybe more so than even in 1929, between the ultra haves. And then everyone else. And this is the one way. This is one way to get there. And this is the great thing. What's the difference between what he has done and then some of these huge, huge guys who are supposedly legitimate, businessmen,
mm-hmm.
have you? And that was always the great thing. That was the great thing about the Godfather movies or Scarface. There really isn't. At the end of the day, there's not that much difference. And I know that it might sound cartoonish to a lot of people and simplistic. But that is what I think a lot of these things are getting at.
That comes to mind also the line in the Godfather, the beginning of the second Godfather,
mm-hmm.
where Michael says, we're all part of the same hypocrisy.
That's
talking
right.
to the senator.
Mm-hmm.
But don't think it applies to my family. And the thing about Breaking Bad as well is the family isn't, well, the wife is certainly no longer clean. I mean, that ended a couple of seasons ago.
Right. But the son is clean.
Yeah, the son and, I think for whatever reason, let's bring up this too. The women on the show get a really bad rap. And I've noticed not only Skylar, but Marie.
She's insane.
I've noticed particularly that women don't like them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is interesting. Well, I mean, with Marie, she displays kind of her insanity early on, and that carries on even into the fifth season when she decides to walk out with Skyler's baby.
Yeah, oh, God. Oh, my God.
Tank has to turn her back and everything. But
my brother was yelling at the TV.
Yeah,
but
that's not, you can understand why she would do that. I mean, that's not,
right.
that's not a stable
no,
home
no,
for that
no.
baby. And
it's
also,
very human
Marie,
move.
Also
yeah.
Marie is, I mean, the relationship between Marie and Hank is very loving. They're largely very respectful and loving to one. You really get a sense of partnership in a genuine
mm-hmm.
form between the two of them. So I can't understand why women are so kind of vociferous against
right.
Marie.
Mm-hmm.
Like she's just annoying. And it's interesting because they say the same thing about Skylar because in a certain way she tries to subvert her husband's moving up in the ranks. I mean,
right.
we get off on him becoming more and more villainous, and Skylar's there to kind of point her finger. She's always the kind of the lecturer in the background, and
right,
we resent
right, right.
her for that.
She's become like more and more of an interesting character as it's gone on,
yeah.
as the show has gone on. I think she's at the peak of her. Yeah, because we have to realize that Skylar, I mean, theoretically, this show takes place within a year or whatever. I know that's hard to believe, but it really does take place in less, like a year and 2 months or something like that. And let's remember that Skylar is pregnant most of this time.
Mm-hmm.
So, nothing against pregnant ladies or whatever, but they're not the most rational people. I mean, they've got a lot of stuff going on in their bodies.
But that's another thing about the show and what I find so great about the show. You know, I did an interview with our local newspaper because they wanted my thoughts on Breaking Bad. They're going to run an article in Sunday's paper. So I said, you know what this reminds me of? I said, people talk about this being a golden age of television, and I think that Breaking Bad is emblematic of that. Just like people said the last golden age of movies was the 70s. And what distinguished those movies in the 70s, it was the notion of the anti-hero. And in Breaking Bad, we have the ultimate anti-hero. Really, really, it's infected a lot of the other characters in the piece, particularly Skyler, because that's a very shocking kind of turn that she makes, I think, at the end of the second, beginning of the third season, whatever it was, where she decides to go along with Walt. To not turn him in, effectively be his partner in crime when she says, we got to buy the car wash. It's encouraging to me that people watch these kinds of shows because they're not easy. Because you're conflicted on how to feel about these characters. They're not black and white.
Mm-hmm. No, I think we really do at the end of the day, you know, we do like that. I think that was the appeal of The Shield, The Sopranos. To a degree, Mad Men, because I don't think there's no one good on Mad Men. They're just lesser degrees of evil. We like these guys, but we like Tony Soprano. We like the guy from The Shield. We love Walter White. I don't love is the right word, but there's something about him that we like. We do like the bad guys a lot. We really do. And they're not bad. What did Joe Mantegna call them? The good bad guys. You know, we do like these characters a lot. We like Omar on The Wire. You know, we do really gravitate towards these kind of characters, I think. There's something about us living vicariously through them.
But Walter White has been somewhat different from something like a Tony Montana, even though, you know, he might end up like Tony Montana this final episode. But he's different because you still see glimpses of good in him. In large credit to Bryan Cranston and his performance.
Right.
I'm telling you, the other week, that phone conversation he had with Skyler when the FBI was listening, and he's playing two competing emotions. I mean, his face has to read one thing while he's speaking another emotion altogether. And there's such humanity and pain and sensitivity in that performance, in that scene, that you know, you're very empathetic towards him. And yet, looking at the arc of his character, there's very little reason to be.
Right, no, true.
I'm sorry.
You have no right to discuss anything about what I do. What the hell do you know about it anyway?
Nothing. I built this place. Me alone, nobody else.
You're right.
You mark my words, Skyler. Toe the line, or you will wind up just like Hank.
Well, tell me what happened. Where is Hank? Please, we need to know.
You're never going to see Hank again.
He's crossed me. You think about that. Family or no.
You let that sink in.
I mean, don't get me wrong, I think Tony Montana, and Tony Montana's actually grown on me in my later years, but he's a lot smarter than Tony Montana. I mean,
the problem with him now is that he's not using his smarts. And it's something, he's running purely on emotion and impulse, I think, a lot more now. Yeah. And that's the downfall.
Well, that's the thing, that the absence of Jesse in his life in this later part of the series, where they're really separated most of the time, mm-hmm. they're not together.
Right.
Jesse was somebody that was an interesting character in that he often turned to Walter White and in times of trouble and said, "Okay, come on, you're the smart guy. Think of something smart. You know, think of something smart. I know I'm not the smart guy, so you do it." And it forced Walt into using his head at times when nothing else was there.
Right.
And I think in the absence of having Jesse, who was really the last person to command him to use his brain, I think in the absence of that, I think that he's fallen into a trap, into the trap of his own emotions or whatever.
Yeah.
And
but there's also
such
beautiful depth. There's so many layers at work, because we talk about either empathizing or loathing Walter White based on his moral conduct. So I mean, a big turning point was when he allowed Jesse's girlfriend to choke and die on her own vomit.
Mm-hmm.
And then Walter White becomes more of a father figure to Jesse. There's a great scene, highly emotional, when he finds him in a crack house or something.
Mm-hmm.
And says, "Jesse, you got to get out of here. You got to get out of here." And Jesse kind of latches onto him, and he's sobbing, and he says, "I loved her. I loved her." And you see him in other scenes after that, kind of taking on a very paternal presence and a comforting presence. So you think, you know, this is like a father-son dynamic. But on the other hand, there's also the nefarious aspect of that, which is he knows that he's got him on a reel, and he can reel him in and make him do whatever he wants, as long as he establishes the sense of false trust and father-son dynamic.
And then at the same time, Jesse knows that he has everything. He's the only one that knows 99% of everything that Walt has
mm-hmm.
done. So
mm-hmm.
he has something on Walt there. So that's the thing that's standing in their way. The show, the earlier shows are interesting because they're kind of funny in the sense of showing Walt, you know, being somebody who can't really understand the younger generation or whatever. And that's a really interesting through line that's gone all the way through, even to now. I mean, he can't understand anything that his son is doing either. For everything that Walt says about his family or whatever, you know, he doesn't really understand his son very much either. I mean, his son,
mm-hmm.
Walt Jr. Is a very kind, you know, human being and is smart in his way, but he's also somebody that's just miles away from his namesake, and really they don't really understand each other all that much. I mean, there's that one scene where Walter White takes Walt Jr. out to drive or whatever for the first mm-hmm. time. He says, "Let's go out and do something fun," and they're in the car together, and Walt Jr. can barely keep his mouth shut, because he's like, "This is not fun for me. This is not fun for me for you to tell me, you know, to be so dogmatic about telling me how to drive, because I really kind of know what I'm doing here." And
yeah.
So there's all this talk about family and all that stuff. In the end, it's really all about you. And then,
right.
You wouldn't even really care about. Oh, so you care about your family, but really you don't care about anybody else. So really, it's just all about, like, oh, my genes are better than yours. You know.
I think that
your family. So
I do think that I started out his intention started out with the family. But
right.
I think
all that stuff, I guess what I'm saying is, for me, all that stuff is based in cliche in some way. Because really, at the beginning of the show, his family is really not all that great.
They're really not talking
at the dinner table or anything like that. It's not really the most dynamic family. Oh man, this family has to live forever because it's so great. I mean, come on, it's worth 1,000 people dying over this family. No, it's not really. I mean, it's not.
Well, I do think in his mind it is genuinely in the beginning, and then the process unlocks something in him. It's like when, you know, and it also unlocks the idea that he finally probably feels like a man, feels like the earner that he never was.
I have made a series of very bad decisions, and I cannot make another one.
Why did you make these decisions?
For the good of my family.
Then they weren't bad decisions. What does a man do, Walter? A man provides for his family.
This costs me my family.
When you have children, you always have family. They will always be your priority, your responsibility. And a man provides. And he does it even when he's not appreciated or respected or even loved. He simply bears. He does it
because he's a man.
There's that part where he's got $1 million or however much he has, and yet his son has built this website, and they're having to funnel the money through the website. And he's like, this is crazy. I have $1 million, and I can't tell my family. And they're saying, well, we'll make up a story or whatever. He says, no, I don't want anyone else taking credit for my work or taking credit for the money that I earn.
Right.
I mean, that's when the kind of true dark nature of him kind of peers out, and you know, well, this is more about him.
So partially, you know, I think that's a good point. One of the problems is that he's not able to boast to his family, really, about how much he's helped them and so forth. There's something missing there. It's like it's like having a number missing out of an equation or whatever. It's like, you know, it's an element that's not... in a show that's about elements, chemical elements working together and so forth, this is one element in the chemistry equation that's not there. For the family as a whole to be thankful and to actually treasure his ability, and then also that the treasuring of his earning ability has something to do with how much they respect him and so forth. Mm-hmm. If that's missing, then really what are you working for, really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, and there's also the great moment where he goes to Gus at the chicken restaurant, which Gus is one of the great villains ever in any series.
Yeah.
Giancarlo Esposito. So he goes to see him and he says, look, this isn't me. I'm not the bad guy. This is after his wife leaves him. And so he's got nothing left to fight for, to do this for. And then Gus essentially says, you know, work with me for 3 more months and you'll make $3 million. And he can't resist it.
Who could resist that? I mean, wow.
Even when he tries to be the good guy,
yeah.
He can't.
Yeah.
He is that guy. You're already that guy. You just don't know it yet. You know.
Well, I think it's interesting also, going back and watching the show, too, how many times that Walt has been on the verge of really getting out. I mean, you really believe that he's ready to get out and everything, but there's the people around him, not his family, but his cohorts in the business, whether it be Saul Goodman,
mm-hmm.
or Jesse, mainly Jesse. I mean, There's one point where Jesse, I mean, he's out, and Jesse says, come on, you got to come back in, because, you know, we can't do this without you, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also that fascinating thing where Jesse is able, you know, comes around and is able to cook just as well as Walt was.
Yeah, that's a big thing. That's a very big thing.
But Walt says, yes, but it's not my thing. It's not my thing. It's not the same.
Yeah.
It looks a little cloudy or whatever.
He's very narcissistic, Walt.
Yeah.
He is a narcissist. Hey, here's my question about Jesse. You know, I always thought Jesse is a character that, unlike Walt, he is... He deserves to be redeemed. He deserves his redemption.
Mm-hmm.
But especially after last week.
Actually,
last week was when my thought changed. I think he still deserves redemption. But
mm-hmm.
When they shot his girl, the mother of the child, which was one of the most devastating murders I've seen on the series, I thought, well, he really doesn't have anything left. I mean, how incredibly guilt-stricken would that act leave him? I mean, I don't think he'd have any will to do anything after that.
Mm-hmm. No, that's true, but he might. God, let me ask you this, though. I mean, Walt's entrance into this, I mean, if you really think about it, if he had never done this, never gone into this world, a lot of these people's like, you know, it's amazing how much destruction. I mean, he's like a violent version of Pigpen from Peanuts. He has created this just storm of chaos with his entrance into this business. It's amazing.
Chris, I know you're a rabid fan. You were actually the first person to tell me that I need to watch Breaking Bad, and so I proceeded to do the marathon and got really into it. So I've studied every episode because of your urging. So that's why I wanted your voice in this. I mean, if you had to describe Breaking Bad and what sets it apart kind of in the annals of TV history, I mean, what makes it such a phenomenal show for you?
That's tough. You know, I'm like you. Someone else was urging me to watch it, and it was like two seasons in, and I was like, yeah, I finally watched it. And then when you watch it, it has this addictive quality, no pun intended. Especially in these days where people can consume a television show in a weekend or something like that, you know? I mean, part of me thinks maybe that's kind of what they had in mind when they were making this show. So many TV shows, the first season and maybe the second season, feels like that was all cooked up from the beginning, that was the idea. And then when you get to season 3, season 4, it feels like, they're kind of making it up as they go along here.
Yeah.
Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And it's never worked as well for me with any show as it does with Breaking Bad. That's the
mm-hmm.
one thing that sets it apart for me is everything that has ever happened on that show feels so organic. Again,
mm-hmm.
no pun intended. Like, there's nothing that's ever happened on the show that really... I don't think I've ever had a moment on that show where I was like, oh, come on, or, you know, anything like that. It all
mm-hmm.
felt so reasonable and so organic, and the way...
There's no throwaway stuff. There's no fat.
No.
I think is what you're saying. There's no fat whatsoever.
Well,
I mean, even The Sopranos had fat. I mean, a lot of episodes... Yeah,
it did. Yeah, absolutely. But also with Breaking Bad, I mean, you're right. There's not – if you take Breaking Bad's weakest episode, it's still pretty damn good. I mean, there's not a weak episode or a weak string or a weak – certainly not a weak season in the group. And you can't really say that about many other TV shows.
Break it down. Further than that, there's not even really weak character decisions. The character decisions seem so reasonable. Like, that seems like what Jesse would do. Even if you don't understand it, in an episode's time or two episodes' time, you start going, oh, now I see where... I mean, these characters are so layered and so thinking about so many different things.
Yeah.
They haven't... They never wrote themselves into a ditch like Lost did several times.
You know, but
it doesn't have that problem.
Yeah, but this talks about the brilliance of it, because Vince Gilligan talks about it a lot. You know, he says we're constantly writing ourselves into a corner, and we rack our brains to figure out a way out of it. So in the writer's room, they've done that. And I think that's what makes the series so exciting, too, because mm-hmm. because they don't have it all planned out. There's this spontaneous sense of urgency
mm-hmm.
because it was written like that. It was written that way with that process.
Well, I noticed something different happening. You know, there's the first and second seasons, but when they finally, I think a major turning point in the series is when they introduced Saul Goodman, because mm-hmm. there's that sense that Saul Goodman is already sort of a good bad guy, as we were talking about, who's mm-hmm. already working in that world. And has not really gotten on the bad side yet in some way, because he's funny, I guess, is the main thing. I mean, that was something that the show really, I think, really needed, was that sort of over the top sort of sense of humor that
mm-hmm.
that Saul Goodman had, but also Saul Goodman's ability to solve problems was something, because he had his hand in so many different pies
mm-hmm.
that he was able to come back around and use some of those people that he had connections with to solve some of the problems, and I think that created a whole other outgrowth of I'm sitting there thinking about the writers being in that room, the room that they work in, you know, from season one to season five, you know, and I can certainly sense that when they came up with the idea of Saul Goodman, that in some ways solved a lot of their problems, you know, writing themselves
yeah.
in the corners, because they could always bring Saul Goodman in a very believable way, you know.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
I mean,
I was talking more about
incidents, like when Walt and Aaron Paul are trapped in the RV and Hank tries to break into the RV in the towing yard. They talked about writing that scene, and they said, "Oh gosh, we've written ourselves in a corner. We have no idea how to get Walt out."
Yeah, but who do they bring out in that corner? They bring out Saul Goodman.
Oh,
who is the guy that Walt calls? He calls Saul Goodman.
Better call him.
Yeah.
So
the guy that gets him out.
So let's. I want to talk about favorite episodes, favorite scenes, and then speculate with you guys on how you'd like it to end. So Chris, we'll start with you. You know, favorite episode, scenes, whatever comes to mind.
Believe it or not, I've only ever seen every episode of the show once. I've never gone back and watched, any of the. Prior episodes, although I did
mm-hmm.
catch about five minutes, ironically, of the episode called Better Call Saul the other day, which is where they meet Saul and first meet up with him. But I'll say, you know, in terms of best episodes, it's pretty tough, I think, in years to come. It's going to be pretty tough not to think of course, everyone always says The Fly, which is a great episode, but it's pretty tough not to think of this final season. That's what's pretty shocking. I don't think there's ever been a final season of a TV show where they were just dropping like bombs, these
mm-hmm.
great episodes after one after another, and everyone seems more important than the previous one, and they are more important than the previous
yeah.
one. So now it's built up. There's one left, and it's like,
it
oh
has
my god!
To,
like,
it has to be. It can't be this. It can't be like the letdown. And then it wasn't even a letdown. The Dexter finale, which may go down, I think, is the worst series finale of all time.
It would have to be like an animated musical for it to be a letdown. Other than
yeah.
that, like, there really isn't much.
Yeah,
it would
have to be
it.
Like the, you know, the Care Bears movie meets My
right.
Little Pony or some crap like that. No, but
yeah,
I mean, agree with you, Chris. This season, I mean, the shoot, the thing that ended with the shootout, and then that cliffhanger, I mean, everyone's
yeah.
just on the edge of their seat for a week. You're just like, you know, come on, let's get
to
next Sunday
episode.
Already.
I have a couple of episodes. I like the episode called Half Measures. I like the end of that episode. It's one of the greatest holy shit moments in the history of the show for me, because it ends with Aaron Paul is walking up to these two drug dealers with a gun in his hand. He's going to shoot them. They turn around. They see him. They point their guns. There's about to be a big shootout. And Walter White comes screeching around the corner in his car and drives over the two drug dealers, gets out of his car and shoots one of them in the head dead, and then turns to Jesse, who's looking at him with this look of shock on his face. The camera, like, dollies up in a very dramatic fashion with a low angle up to Walt's face, and he says,
"Run,
run." And the show ends, that episode ends. You could the excitement that I felt, like the adrenaline that I felt at the end of that episode was amazing. And then there's talk about writing yourself in a corner and getting out of it brilliantly. There's that episode Salute, which is the one where Gus wipes out the cartel, wipes out his competition by poisoning the liquor. And I thought, oh my God, this is the most brilliant villainous plot I've ever seen unfold, particularly
that
in a TV
series.
Could
be its own movie. It could be its own movie, easily.
Yeah.
One episode.
Yeah. So those two definitely come to mind. And then there's the whole thing with the plane crash that you mentioned earlier, Dean. There's a great moment, and this is an episode that actually Bryan Cranston himself directed. There's a great moment when the father of the girl that dies of the overdose, he's trying to pick out a dress for his daughter to wear in her coffin. And it's a very painful scene. And he gets out this blue dress and lays it out on the bed. And he's talking to the girl's mother on the phone, says, "No, it's blue. It's very pretty. It'll be pretty." And he's looking at it, and he stretches out the arms of the dress on the bed. And then it cuts to Walter changing his baby's diaper, and the baby is in the same pose in the crib.
Yeah.
And, mm-hmm. Oh, my God, just like a breathtaking, devastating cut. That means much. You know, you feel the death of a child in that moment.
Well, I don't have specific episodes, but I have specific scenes that I really like. I mean, you know, starting with the first season, you know, I really love that scene with Walter White going down into the basement to talk with Crazy Eight for the first time.
Yeah,
and Crazy Eight tries to you know get close with him, and it seems very real, you know, the way that actor portrays Crazy Eight and actually has that character connecting with his former self in such a way that really makes you empathize with him for a little bit, and then mm-hmm. of course it's horribly over. But also in the first season, I really loved the intervention scene, the scene where Walter's entire family sits him down and starts asking him what's going on. It's the first scene in the show where you really get the sense of a web of lies that's affecting this small group of people.
Well, you also see for the first time all of those principal characters interacting. So you feel the world that they're going to be inhabiting all together for really the first time too. That's
right.
Betsy Brandt's favorite scene, I think, the one that plays Marie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a tremendous scene. I guess the most explosive scene, literally the most explosive scene in the first season is where he goes to Tuco's palace and throws that one little bit of that explosive substance down and almost blows up the entire floor of the place. That was really shocking. That was something that up until that point you didn't know if this show was going to go to this height, you know, of sort of action, you know. You know, the scene with the ATM machine crushing the guy's head, that was in the second season. That was
That was amazing. Because it really gave you the sense of the squalor that the addicts of this drug actually live in. Tortuga, you know, the tortoise, you know, Danny Trejo's character, you know, his head on the tortoise and the, and it glowing up, you know, in the second season. That was amazing.
Let me stop you right there for a second. The one problem that I, the only problem I've ever had with this show, and I kind of understand the thinking behind it, but it still feels, for Breaking Bad, it feels too obvious and jokey and unrealistic. I never quite liked the twins, the stoic, silent twins that turned to one another in unison and all of that kind of thing. It just, for this show, it just felt false to me. Anybody else feel that way?
I kind of liked it, but I'm glad that they were dispatched so quickly because it got a little old, you know. They weren't really characters as much as presences or whatever, and that's not what this show is, you know. It's really more about characters. So I don't know. There was something there that that you were just like, okay, let's get these guys out of it here. You know,
no.
But luckily they weren't around for very long.
And they had a good ending, I mean, with Hank. I mean, it crescendoed it in a very satisfying way with Hank when Hank ended up dispatching of them both. But okay, real quick, a couple more moments, and then we'll move on.
Well, a lot of, you know, Gus killing his henchman with the box cutter, that was shocking. And, of course, Gus's death. That was unbelievable. And then when you get into the fifth season with, Skylar and Hank at the diner and her confession, you know, are you arresting me or am I under arrest? You know, that was just, I mean, that scene went on for like, that scene was so rare because you don't see like 20-minute scenes like that. I mean, that scene was like at least 15 minutes long, you know, just them at the diner. And that's just something that you don't see in television very often. So that was something else. And hijacking of the train, you know, of the train earlier on, which culminates with the kid showing up and Todd having to turn around and shoot the kid. I mean, that was unbelievable. And the revelation, Walt's final revelation to his son and the stealing of the baby. And then finally, I just have to say, you know, this last episode, you know, I have to say when Robert Forster showed up, I could not believe it when I saw Robert Forster. I was like, oh, my God, he's in this episode. This is unbelievable now. Now we're getting into
Robert Forster genuinely is the nicest guy I've ever interviewed. he's the genuine real deal. And they were writing that role in the writer's room, and they thought, you know, it needs to be a Robert Forster type. So they said, well, why don't we just see if Robert Forrest will do it. So they were fortunate enough to get him. Chris, I want to know, because we haven't talked about Breaking Bad a lot between the two of us, but I want to know how you don't want it to end.
Well, that's a tough question as it pertains to this show. So there's a lot of, people are even filling out like scoreboards of, you know, all the different characters and who's going to live and who's going to die and how they're going to die and all this kind of stuff, and I wouldn't presume to predict that. I don't know if there's going to be a lot of deaths or what, but really Walter White's the most important one. All the other characters are ancillary. It's about Walter White.
Right.
I think that's why people identify with the show, because his initial premise, I'm going to die, I'm leaving behind a family, what can I do? That's what people really... Like, if you boil it down, that's what gets people into the show. And, you know, everybody sort of
says, right.
Well, that could happen to me. And the thing is,
he's
getting into it for the right reasons, and we all understand that, but he has turned into someone who has gone too far. Like, he has allowed these things to happen. He's killed people like Crazy Eights and Tuco and people like this and Gus, who probably deserve to die. but he's also ultimately responsible for the deaths of, you know, the boy and, you know, Jesse's girlfriend who was just killed the other night and many others. Not to mention the fact that he is cooking methamphetamines and ruining millions of lives across the country and even the world at this point. So he has turned evil. It's gone too far. Walt, although we identify with him and probably he'll get, you know, he'll be saved a little bit, ultimately, I feel that, like, you know, I mean, Walter does have to die, probably will die. So I don't want it to end in any way that that sort of dismisses the fact that Walter has made a conscious decision to do this for his family, knowing the consequence. And I think Walter would say the same thing. I know the consequences, you know. He did this for his family, and so he's going to get that. His family's going to get what they want, but he has to die. Either by cancer or by Nazi.
Didn't you guys just, were you all cringing and just kicking yourselves when the Nazis took his money, almost all of it? I was just, like, going nuts.
Yeah, you were, but at the same time, you're going, ah, that's what the guns were. Like, everybody's sort of trying to piece together. It's a lot like the season two, I think it was, with the eyeball and the plane crash, where you're sort of, it's almost like a puzzle that's coming together as a season. This one just started with this one big piece at the beginning of the season, which was, what the fuck are we going to do with this piece? What's with Walter
Beard
and at Denny's with the 51 and all this kind of stuff? And now that was the moment when it came together. When the Nazis turned bad, it's like, oh, okay, yes. Now I get it. It's something to do with that.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that Walter has to die. And I think he has to die for the reasons that you just stated. I mean, you can't, his sins cannot be dismissed. If I had to guess, though, I think that Walter's going to die in his own terms, though. I think he's going to use the rice and cigarette.
On himself.
Yeah.
I personally don't want to see Walter White die. I kind of want to see. I want to see him get away with it.
You want to see him get away with murdering a child?
Well, I mean, you want to see him get away with it?
Well,
I mean, let me just say this.
I think that it would be much more torturous for Walter White to live with his own feelings than to just simply die. In other words, is it more cruel to put some criminal away in total isolation forever until they die, you know, 60 years later or whatever it is, or put them to death immediately? And
yeah, but that option's off the table because he's got terminal cancer.
He's going to die soon anyway.
Well, we don't really know that because his cancer's gone into a remission and so forth. We don't really know that, you know. But really, what I would be interested in seeing more, and it would feel more like, you know, one of those 70s movies or whatever, if he just lives but had to live with the consequences for however long that is. I understand what you're saying.
You mean like Michael at the end of part three where he obviously dies in seclusion and he has to live with his sins? Is that what you mean? Like something along those lines?
That kind of thing.
He means like crimes and misdemeanors. Like
Yeah, exactly.
I mean I completely get that. But, the reason why I think that's off the table is because it's been made clear that he's going to die of cancer, and I don't think a final episode with an hour and 15 minutes is enough time to have them solve everything and then him to find out, oh, you're in remission again. I do agree with you that that would be a very 70s kind of more ambiguous ending. I think, like I said last week on the show, if you're going with the basic premise of Mr. Chips to Scarface, then he's got to go out in a blaze of glory. I mean, I think he's got to die like the ultimate villain.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that he's going to have victory before that. I think a lot of Nazis are going to die.
So I hope they get. But you mean like Tony with Frank Leotardo and everything when all those guys were getting whacked?
But unlike the Sopranos, unlike The Sopranos, I mean, Vince Gilligan has made it clear that there's no ambiguity with this ending.
Yeah. You ask, what do you not want from the show? That's what I do not want from the show, a nice big art fart of an ending like The Sopranos.
Let me ask you guys this.
Well, let's face it, though. I mean, we know what happened in The Sopranos. Let's just be clear. I think we know from what...
We don't know because they didn't film it because it went to black. Some people think they know, and other people think they know.
No, you know. I mean, that guy, he went into the bathroom.
I don't know. I wasn't in the writer's room. I don't know.
Tony's dead. He dies. He dies right
well,
before
that's
we
what,
see
Well, that's what's great about the ending of Sopranos is... The fact that they don't show it, it becomes kind of a litmus test for the viewer. Where do you side? Where do you side? And people think
opposite
things.
And that's what I like about. That's what I like about an ending like that. That's what I don't think that it's an art fart sort of ending. I think it's exactly what you say. It's a litmus test for how you feel. That's exactly what
The Sopranos. Yeah. Especially in retrospect, you can look back and say, "Oh, that was a really ideal way to end The Sopranos and a ballsy way to end it." I mean, I can accept it when it comes to The Sopranos. I just think
Movie with a villain should end that way. Every movie with a villain is just fade to black, and then we all go, "You know what happened." Like,
well, let me ask you: let's talk about in the recent decade since The Sopranos, some other. Series finales that, I mean, I think the ending of 6 Feet Under was perfect. I like the ending of The Wire. I thought those were two very good series finales. What have been some horrible ones, though, in your guys' minds?
Well, that was kind of my point. That was kind of my point by asking what you don't want to happen at the end of Breaking Bad, because, I mean, everyone on the show, which why would they say anything else? Everyone on the show said it's a very satisfying ending.
Well, everyone on the end of Lost said that, too. And Lost did exactly what people do not want, which is they try to please everybody. They try to have it both ways. And that's what Breaking Bad's just not that kind of show. You can't have it both ways.
You're not going to get that.
Now, I wouldn't want an episode. I wouldn't want a finale like Lost, that's for sure. That would be bad. But,
well, Lost is very... I still am conflicted about the end of Lost. I mean... So some days I like it, the other days I'm like, whatever.
Yeah.
I hated it from the beginning. And
I think that Walter's going to wake up next to another wife and say, "Oh, I had the weirdest dream." It's going to be just
that
like
was
the
a
New
classic,
show.
Classic, classic ending.
Yeah, let's do the ending like the Saint Elsewhere ending where it's revolved in the mind of an autistic.
What the hell? I was thinking about that earlier. What
Or they could end it like Seinfeld, where Walt and Aaron Paul are in a cell together talking about nothing, and then it kind of pans back and Anyway,
that would be a supremely unsatisfying ending, as if you just went to jail. That's all.
Mm-hmm. I think so.
I mean, that would be terrible.
Go ahead, Chris.
Well, it's a show that it's not like all these other shows that it's ultimately going to be compared to of its time. You know, The Sopranos and Mad Men and things like that. The other candidates for maybe greatest show of this time that we're living in, which is like a golden age for cable television.
Yeah.
The difference between those shows and Breaking Bad is that everyone can identify with the character of Walter White. You know, not everyone's a meth dealer, but, you know, everyone can put themselves in this situation where they feel like, okay, it's them or you. You choose. Are you going
to
be a bad
guy?
Exactly.
Your back
is
to the wall.
Yeah, your balls are to the wall, now you choose. You know, you can't really picture yourself as, you know, a 1960s ad guy, you know, like who's cheating on his wife and may have previous identity and all this kind of weird shit. Like, that's kind of, and Mad Men's a great show and it deals with interesting themes, but, like, Walter White himself is identifiable.
He is more of an everyman.
Yeah, they got to end it in a way that that people can accept. And I think, ultimately, you don't have to please everybody to do that. You just end it like they've done the show entirely, which is organically. He makes the right choices, and people enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
There's also the notion that You know, what was curious to me is how Betsy Brandt wasn't in a lot of the last episode, which, you know, there wasn't a place for her in the drama of that episode. But, I mean, she obviously has to come into play here, and, you know, especially if they find her husband. Which, by the way, I mean, I said this last week, Hank to me is like, Hank has been the greatest arc outside of Walter White for me in this show. Because he's, at a certain point, the more deeper into descent that Walt plummeted, the more love and affection you felt for Hank and empathy. So that was a really painful death. In a lot of ways, it felt like the show lost its beating heart when Hank was shot and killed.
Jack, 80 million. And all you've got to do is let him go.
That's a hell of an offer. What do you think, Fred? Would you take that deal?
It's Hank. His name is Hank.
How about it, Hank? Should I let you go?
My name is Asax Schrader. You can go f*** yourself.
Hank. Listen to me. You gotta tell him. You gotta tell him now that we can work this out. Please. Please.
What? You want me to beg? You're the smartest guy I ever met. And you're too stupid to see. He made up his mind 10 minutes ago. Do what you're gonna do.
I was thinking about Hank when you were talking about the two Mexican dudes, the two silent dudes. You know, I think if they stuck around long enough, they probably would have become interesting, because that's what the show has done with all the characters. It's taken characters who seem like characters at first, and then they stick around long enough and they have this very interesting arc. You know, it's true of Hank, it's certainly true of Skyler, it's true of Jesse to a large extent, and even Walt, and many of the other characters. So, but yeah, you're right. No one more so than Hank. Hank is, you know, he started off as just, you know, like the character you've seen in a ton of other shows, and he became something much, much more.
Now he's under the dome.
Yeah.
Yeah. What? Anything else we want to talk about in terms of Breaking Bad?
There's tons of great things, you know, about the show. I mean, just to toss off a few. I mean, I love the silence in the show. You know, it's unlike any other television show in the sense that it's not overscored or anything. When there's music that comes on, it's very significant. There's virtually no underscoring to the show, so it's just like every episode is just when there's a dialogue scene, your attention is laser focused on the performances and the words there, and nothing else is getting in the way.
It doesn't need any other hyped up drama, because the drama is intense enough on its own.
Right.
Exactly. You know,
and also the photography is amazing.
Yeah, the photography, which really changed from the initial episodes, and it was very sort of average-looking kind of photography. And then as they got deeper into it, it became more and more expressive and very, very polarized.
Well,
that's because
they changed cinematographers. They went with Michael Slavis for the second, I think, starting on the second season, and he had some very experimental ways to shoot it, and he was so afraid that he was going to get fired by AMC, and AMC said, "We love it, keep this look," and he's photographed all of it, he's directed some episodes, so I mean it has a consistency, especially starting in that second season. I think in large part because of his work.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I love all the always, you know, the surprising intros. You never know how the show is going to begin. Each episode, you know, each episode begins with a, you know, a certain image that's somehow linked into the elements, you know, of water or air or fire or earth, you know, there's, all of that stuff is always there. And, you know, and then going back to even that amazing set of intros that sort of kind of led up to the revelation of the plane crash in midair, and you know, I mean, there's one episode in the early part of that season that begins with stuff floating in the pool, and it's never referred to, and it's brought back, you know, a couple episodes later, and it finally pays off in the last episode of that season, and I just never seen a show do anything like that ever. I just have to say, you know, I love Bob Odenkirk in the show. I just love that character. Mm-hmm. And I'm really, really, I don't know how much I'm going to like the spinoff show, Better Call Saul. But I will say this. Every time that character comes on in the show, I'm just like, oh, I love him. He's great.
Years ago, before Breaking Bad even became a hit, we interviewed three of the eventual co-stars of the show. We're going to play some snippets from these interviews now. First, you'll hear from actor Stephen Bauer, who broke through starring opposite Al Pacino in 1983's Scarface, an iconic role in an iconic movie that made him the perfect candidate to play the role of Don Eladio in Breaking Bad. The excerpts from Mr. Bauer's interview will be followed by our conversation with actor Mark Margolis, another performer who made a big mark in Scarface. Mr. Margolis plays the intimidating disabled character Tio. And finally, we'll hear from Robert Forrester, one of our great character actors, who made a surprise appearance in last week's episode. After many decades in film, Mr. Forrester staged a tremendous comeback with his unforgettable performance in Quentin Tarantino's Jackie Brown. In Breaking Bad, he played the disappearer, the one who sets up Walter with a new life in New Hampshire.
Look at that. Look, you're missing all the sight. That's what you're doing. We're missing the action.
Oye, sabrosura. You want to have some ice cream with my friend of me?
Get lost, goofball.
Look at that.
Ice cream?
Sorry?
You said ice cream?
Girl like ice cream.
Oh, come on, man. That's not going to work.
Do you remember the first time you met Al?
Yes, actually, the first time I met Al was this is really ironic, because I met him, I don't know if he remembers this, but I met him at a cafe in the village. After seeing him, some friends took me to see him in Buffalo, in American Buffalo, and I think I sat like in the fourth row or something, and I was just knocked out, right? And then but after the show, we got invited to go to this cafe. To this bar or something, and we sat at a big table, a lot of people, and I sat on a corner, and he sat at the head of the table. So I sat literally inches from him. I don't think I said a word to him, but that must have been in the spring, it must have been the spring or in the winter of 82. And then right after that was the audition, the first audition. And then I started the auditioning process and the meetings with Brian De Palma and then Martin Bregman in L.A., Marty Bregman in Los Angeles, and he gave me the script, and I started, you know, reading the script and learning the part and preparing to meet Al, because the whole deal was, well, you're our choice, but you know Al's gonna make, you know, he's gotta come on board
decision, yeah.
You know, he's gotta meet you, but I couldn't meet Al for, you know, God knows, the whole summer went by, and I still hadn't met Al. And then finally they put us together in a room, and it was I like to call it love at first sight. It was chemistry, you know, when you like you meet like when you meet the girl, you know, and
yeah.
And it's like, oh boy, it was like firework. It just, you know, we just like hit it off immediately. So it was kind of, that was really the first time we met because, like I said, I mean, I sat inches from him, but I don't think I talked to him all night.
Yeah. I understand that you and Al were pretty inseparable during the shoot.
Yeah, during the shoot.
What kind of things did he take from you and vice versa?
Well, the thing is that I really felt, you know, I really felt that what I could offer mostly was the reality of my experience of my being Cuban, of my growing up with that culture,
mm-hmm.
and that if I could bring some of that to the movie, if that could seep, you know, if I could infuse that in some of the other actors who weren't the ones who weren't Cuban, that would be a major, major moral triumph for me, you know, and for where I came from.
Right.
Well, you succeeded.
Yeah. I wanted it to have some authenticity, because it not only was it my first step into the movie, you know, into movies. Really, it was my first movie, my first film. I mean, I've been doing some television, but I really didn't want to enter film, the world of cinema, without it being some sort of, you know, something meaningful, and it was luck that it turned out to be Scarface. It turned out to be this kind of break, obviously opposite him. So in something that had to do with my culture, and my culture being so weird, you know, to the United States. You know, I grew up as a foreigner. You know, really, I was an outsider in the United States, and I was it imbued everything that I was, all my upbringing. You know, being an outsider, you know, as a kid. Luckily, I didn't. You know, I mean, I'm not saying poor me, because there are many who had it much rougher than I did, because I didn't really look like an outsider. I didn't look that. I don't have, you know, I didn't have, like, as a kid, I had lighter hair. I'm like, you know, and I didn't really look like that little Latin kid, you know. So I wasn't picked on that way. But I did have like this big name. My dad's name, my dad's family name is Echevarria. And so I did carry like this big ass long Latin name that nobody could pronounce. And that was a source of tremendous consternation for me in school, because I didn't even want to identify myself. So I was invisible, really, as a kid. I wasn't, you know, I wasn't outgoing. So when I became an actor, when I had the opportunity to do Scarface, I thought, man, if this movie, I mean, it's about Cubans. Finally, I can, like, redeem Cubans in the eyes of, you know, not only, you know, the U.S., but the world, probably. And Bregman, I remember Bregman had told me early on, because there was this possibility that I was going to do, I got an offer to do another film about the same time, right at the same time, and it would have conflicted.
Mm.
And it was a great opportunity. It was a nice film. It was a Canadian film. And it was the lead role. And there were, you know, a lot of people wanted me to do it because it would have been a break. But I was on hold for Al to, you know, to the big meeting with Al. Right? Like that, I had Scarface, but I didn't have it yet. You know, it's like a bird in hand, right? So I had this other film, this Canadian film, and everybody's like, "You're crazy, Stephen. You're an idiot. Take the film. It's real." You know, and other people were telling everybody was saying, "You're not gonna get Scarface. You're deluding yourself." And I said, "No, but," and I'm like, you know, I'd be like the good boy. I'd be like, "No, but Mr. Bregman said." Mr. Bregman told me I'm going to do Scarface. I just have to meet Al. And they'd be like, "Yes, sure. Yeah, right. Oh, what? You're going to believe Mr. Hollywood producer?"
Yeah.
and you're going to turn down an opportunity like this to star in this great little movie. And I said, "Yeah." And then so when push came to shove, and I went to Bregman again, and like one more time. I went to him like 10 times, and I said, "Please," they're begging me, "can I give them some sort of, like, you know, insurance that I'm not crazy for turning down this other film?" And he said, I just want you to think about it, something. He's got a really deep voice. He goes, "I want you to remember this. That movie, that little movie, at the most, it's going to be seen by maybe a few thousand people. Maybe. How many people do you think will see Scarface? He said, just think about that.
Madame, c'est un tipo solo. Sin mujer y sin hijo.
Si el sol se dice que lo hagamos ahora, lo hacemos ahora. Vamos.
It's a weird thing. When I was a kid in Philly, well, I grew up in Philly.
Mm-hmm.
I was sitting with somebody, and we had been talking for a long time. I had sort of thought about acting at one point, and then he was talking about let's become radio announcers. We used to listen to a lot of radio. This was back in the dark ages, and then we went from that to let's become actors. And I thought, yeah, that's what I'd like to do. And he didn't go any further with it, and I said something to my father and ended up, he said, well, why don't you go look into it? And I went downtown in Philly to the Bessie V. Hicks School of Dramatic Arts. I was about 14.
Wow.
Apparently, I think I found out she's some well-known actress from either silent film days or something like that.
Oh.
You're the film buffs. Do you know of Bessie V. Hicks?
I will by the next show. I'll do my research.
I'll definitely look
I don't know. I mean, it could be theater. It could be theater.
Right, right.
I don't know.
But, was there something? What did acting hold for you? What did it do for you?
I'm trying to be. I don't. The best I could say is there were so many things. I was kind of shy about many things and a bit held back. And what it has for me, it still has for me. It allows me to do things that I on my own would never do because I have license from the
mm-hmm.
author to do this or that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm on some level. I'm free of being responsible for doing that. And I can do it, and then if I really get into it, I can do it fully, and it's very, it's a great release because it's something I could never have done. And not always, but that was one of the great things of it.
Yeah. And you did.
And it seemed a good way to meet girls.
Well, that's always important.
That is the most important thing right there, and that's a constant thing I've heard my whole life about it.
Especially if you're a shy person.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I mean, that's just riffing, but
yeah. I mean, I'm considering the acting career myself for that very reason.
Well, it seems that everybody I get stopped every day on the street by somebody asking me how do I get in that acting business.
Right.
And then I say, what do you do? And they say, I work for the city comptroller. And I say, well, how do I get in that comptroller business? It makes me great. Because I don't think people walk up to violinists with the orchestra and say, how do I get in that violin business? But everybody thinks they can be an actor.
Right.
Also,
right.
A lot of people think because they can construct a sentence that they're writers.
Yeah, you studied with Stella Adler.
She was my great teacher. I mean, when I came to Philly, I went to a year of college in Philadelphia, and then was involved with the theater department. Even though I was thinking about going into something else, I had done some plays in Philly, and after I didn't care for the theater department that much. Though the school I went to now has a wonderful, apparently, theater department, but that was a long time ago. And I came to New York to see what the great teachers were like, and I actually had never heard of her. My family, apparently, later I found out, all knew about her. And I had an interview with her with a buddy of mine. We drove in from Philly for the day, and the main thing that hit me was if God is a woman, this is him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Stella taught more than what it was to be more than acting. She taught what it was to be an artist in the world.
Right.
She was quite incredible, and I was scared to death of her for quite a long time.
We've heard that time and time
mm-hmm.
again from
yeah.
some of the guests we've had on the show that studied under Stella.
Well, initially, I mean, I was a 19-year-old kid from Philly, which. I really had never. New York itself was pretty overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
It's a whole other place. I got used to her later. In fact, I traded classes by
assisting her getting home and helping her when she got to her apartment. I checked coats at her parties a couple of times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you studied with Stella, and what became the first break for you that you considered your first break?
I was with Stella for about 3 years, though the course was about two, but I was afraid to break the umbilical cord, so I went a little further.
You went out this morning and bought a gun?
What? I didn't hear you.
You went out this morning and bought a gun?
Well, let's say I got one now, okay?
Somebody loan it to you?
Yeah.
Now, I worked with David Lynch in Mulholland
Absolutely.
Drive.
Yeah.
And I must admit that when I read the script, now, when I read it and shot it, it was a pilot for one of his interesting, odd television shows. You remember the other one, Twin Peaks?
Twin Peaks, yes, sir.
Well, what do I want to say about Twin Peaks? You didn't know where it was going, and
mm-hmm.
neither did we when I read the script of Mulholland Drive. So it was a pilot for a television show. Later, of course, when it didn't succeed as a television show, when it didn't get picked up, they shot some additional material and made it into a standalone movie. But when I shot it, I didn't understand it, nor did I understand where it was going. All I knew was that I was a detective in a situation, and I only shot, a couple of days, couple of half days, couple of half nights. And on my first shooting night, we were on a road, maybe in Griffith Park, above Los Angeles, with all of the beautiful lights of Los Angeles spread out before us. And I walked from the scene of an accident over to the edge of the other side of the road, and I look over Los Angeles, and I say some lines, and I can't remember who I'm talking to at this moment, but I did the scene. And, you know, I have a feeling for the rhythm of a believable line of dialogue, and I mm-hmm. did my line. And David said after the shot, he says, do it slower. And I thought, okay, I can do it slower, and I did it slower. And on the following take, he said, do it slower still. Now I'm beginning to think, what is this guy asking me to do? Because it's not sounding real anymore. It's sounding something else. I finally did the line slower than I can imagine or than I would ever imagine saying a line without saying to a director, hey, guess what? This doesn't sound real to me. I can't do it like that. But this is David Lynch. And I said, okay, Bob, give him the line the way he wants it. Eventually, I realized that this scene was not a real scene but was in a dream,
yeah.
something I didn't know on the set. And going with the director, this is a good director, you know. That's when I said to myself, hey, Bob, don't second-guess the director. This guy knows what he's doing. And finally, when I realized that I was in a dream sequence, then the line, the slowness of the line made sense. But he didn't expose that to me until after the movie was released as a standalone movie.
So did you actually shoot more than that initial scene that ended up in the movie? Did you shoot more for the pilot?
Yeah. Yes, and I can't remember what all stayed in the movie, but if it had gone as into series, he said that he'd, you know, find out when I wasn't working on something else, because at that time I was working a lot. This was right after Jackie Brown, and I had a lot of stuff going on. You know, things cool off after a while, but at that point he said, you'll come in and we'll shoot little scenes, and that'll be my part of the television show. So I was delighted, and this is a guy that I liked long before and was dying to work with. And so anyway, he was extremely nice to me, David Lynch, and working with him, reminds me a little bit of working with James Housler. They're both deliberate, they're both quiet, they're both, you know, reserved, and they ask you to do something, and you think, this guy knows what he wants. Let's give it to him. But I had very little to do in Calamity. I had a lot more to do in Wild 7.
Mm-hmm. Now, we're talking about writing and different styles of writing, and obviously you mentioned Jackie Brown, which is the biggie from from this act of your career.
It's biggie. It's my biggie, I'll tell you.
Yeah, and that Tarantino's dialogue seems, I mean, it obviously is its own music. It has a rhythm all of its own. So that must be a kind of a different monster altogether to tackle.
There was very little room for improvisation in that movie, but that didn't mean that I was constrained in any way, because he wrote this thing so well that, and the way I work on dialogue, I take the script and I read the lines and I try to understand the scene. I try to understand what place the scene has in the movie. You know, there's some detective work, but eventually you put the script down and you try to say the line the way you think you remember the line in the script, and then you go back to the script and see how close you got to the way the guy wrote it. Well, this guy writes material so well that the way you'd phrase something is the way it's written. This guy is so good. We're talking about Tarantino. So whereas there were no real opportunities for improvisation, I needed none, because this guy's dialogue is so good. The only moment in the movie that I can remember, maybe there were others, but the only moment that I can remember in the movie was the very last scene when Pam Grier comes to my office and we kiss. And she is about to leave, and she wants me to go to Spain with her. And I am sort of trying to make up my mind whether I dare leave my office and run away with this woman. And the phone rings. Now, that wasn't in the movie. It wasn't in the script. But while we're shooting that, Quentin says to me, "There'll be a moment in your office when the phone will ring. Pick it up." And there was a moment when the phone rang. And I picked it up, and I improvised what was going on in that telephone call. I pictured some woman whose son was in trouble, and I asked her how old the kid was, maybe, and does he live at home, or is there a father at home? I can't quite remember, but that was improvised. There was just a moment in the movie where, but other than that, Quentin Tarantino writes masterfully, and I know that he wrote it with me in mind, and so, you know, it sort of conformed to me easily.
That's it for this episode of Movie Geeks United. Enjoy the finale of Breaking Bad and share your thoughts with us at moviegeeksunited@yahoo.com.